It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at Congress with Paul Singer of USA Today. We'll hear about congressional reaction to President Obama's proposed budget and testimony from the IRS before a House panel.
First, a bill that would target Common Core education standards in Wisconsin is set for a public hearing tomorrow. If passed, it would create a state academic standards board with the power to review and change educational standards in the state.
Earlier this week, we spoke with Republican State Senator Paul Farrow, one of the legislators behind the bill. Supporters like Farrow say Wisconsin should chart its own course for education as opposed to adopting national standards.
But one of the strongest critics of the bill has been Wisconsin State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Tony Evers. He joins us now to talk about tomorrow's hearing and the challenges facing Common Core. Superintendent Evers, welcome to the show.
Hi, Rob. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good.
Let's start with something you wrote in an opinion piece recently. Senate, quoting, Senate Bill 619 is a partisan takeover of the bedrock of schooling, the standards that describe what our kids should know and be able to do in each academic subject area. Talk a little more about what you see as the specific hazards of this bill.
Well, for the first time ever in the state of Wisconsin, we have a bill in front of us that would essentially put the development and writing of standards in the hands of legislators. I know there's committees that are part of this bill and so on and so forth, but frankly, the committees are stacked. And if my recommendation to the legislature is not something they agree to, it automatically goes to the floor of the legislature. And they could be involved with writing those standards right on the floor. And as a grandfather, I will tell you that keeps me up at night. And it's not just limited to English and mathematics, but this commission can also take a look at any of the 23 areas that we have standards in and put that in the legislator's hands. We could be talking about evolution on the floor of the Senate and the Assembly in a few years when we do science standards. I don't believe the people of Wisconsin believe that we want to politicize this process any more than it has been already, and that's why I'm opposed to this bill.
One of the objections that Senator Farrow, among others, has brought up is that these were national standards put together by people from states, governors, and superintendents of education, but promoted by the federal government. They're not reflective of nuances here in Wisconsin. They don't give us the flexibility we need to meet our specific needs in the state. What's wrong with opening things up to tweaking those standards for Wisconsin?
Well, first of all, it's not given to us by the federal government. It was developed by experts from across the country, including Wisconsin experts who were part of that. Then, in addition, when those standards were finally promulgated by at the national level, not the federal level, the national level, those standards were given to the states, and we got input from all sorts of people across the state of Wisconsin, mainly experts in the field and also classroom teachers. And we provided input, and that input was duly noted, and some of those were accepted. So there's the point that Senator Farrow is making there, I just don't buy. First of all, these standards are good. The Wisconsin schools have been implementing them for a couple of years now with pretty good results. And there's nothing to prevent. There's nothing in those standards that dictate what curriculum is going to be used locally, what textbooks are going to be used locally, or how teachers are going to teach to those standards locally. So there's all sorts of opportunities for local implementation strategies that exist and exist now and will exist in the future. This is really all about politics. This is about who's in control and that sort of thing, which bothers me greatly, because this is about, you know, it's impacting children. It's not just being fought out at the state level. It's fought out. It's creating chaotic situations in local schools where they're wondering, what in the world's going on? We're implementing these standards. We're having great success with that. Why now? And why is this being debated now and looking at changing things now?
Let's follow up that question. It seems like there used to be bipartisan, at least maybe support or at least non-objection to the Common Core standards. Why now? What happened to change that apparent consensus over this?
Well, there's been members of the Tea Party across the United States has been very active in being in opposition to the standards. But, you know, that's just the weird thing about it. Business, you know, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, the Milwaukee Metropolitan Association of Commerce, business leaders across the state support it. Education groups support it. So now we're in this position of having to kind of debate this going forward. The legislature, in two successive bienniums, created money for us to develop a test that is aligned directly to the Common Core standards. So the same legislators who are now saying, oh my gosh, what's happening? We didn't know anything about this. In the last two sessions, bienniums, have provided money for us to implement this. It seems ironic, and you know the governor also has been supportive of the Common Core state standards in the read-delete task force that we both worked on. The final report praised the going forward with the Common Core standards. So clearly, the political climate has changed. We're moving into an election season, and people are looking for votes.
Some of the arguments from people in the Tea Party, as you mentioned, were that, as you said earlier, this was put together by experts nationally and here in the state of Wisconsin, by people in the field of the schools. Not enough, they say, public input, not enough citizen input into what these standards look like. Do you buy that?
No, these standards were open for public comment for a long time and before they were adopted I adopted that in 2010. So no, and to be honest with you, this isn't like writing legislation that adopting the Common Core. This is what's being taught in schools. So it's not, yes, we did things, but frankly, every one of the 424 school districts in the state had discussions around this issue. So it probably had more widespread support than this bill. I mean, this bill hasn't even had a hearing, and they're calling us out on not being transparent. I don't buy it. 424 school districts in the state have been embracing this and involving their parents in it right from the get-go. I've gone across the state. I was elected twice on this platform. So transparency isn't the issue. Politics is.
Well, Senator Farrow said this is just creating a mechanism to maybe alter the Common Core standards. It might be that the committee meets and signs off on Common Core as it is or makes some minor changes. Is that really that big a problem?
Yeah, a fat chance that'll happen. The author of this bill, Senator Vukmir, made it clear from day one that the purpose of this bill, this commission, and this particular procedure is to get rid of the Common Core. I take her at her word.
So if this passes, how do you see the education system changing in Wisconsin?
Well, I think it'll be a sad day. We've had conversations across this country, and people are looking to Wisconsin to do the right thing. I'm fearful that this will send the wrong message to our business community. Certainly, it's going to send the wrong message to our kids that these standards that they've been working on with some success, we're going to have to now start from scratch. I think it could make us look bad across the state and could make us look bad across the country. When our business community is asking us to step forward and make sure our kids are college and career ready, we step up to the plate and then all of a sudden we have to backtrack. That is going to send the wrong message to not only the Wisconsinites but to the United States of America.
Superintendent Evers, thanks for joining us today.
Great. Thank you very much, Rob.
That's Tony Evers, State Superintendent of Public Instruction. We talked with him about the challenge to Common Core standards in Wisconsin. Yesterday, President Obama sent his $3.9 trillion budget to Congress. It's being called a populist wish list by the New York Times.
And tempers erupted this morning at a congressional hearing on the alleged IRS targeting of Tea Party groups.
Also, hours later, the Senate rejected its first nominee from President Obama since they changed their approval rules last November.
Joining us now is Paul Singer, politics and Congress editor at USA Today. He joins us every Wednesday at this time. Paul, welcome back.
How you doing, Veronica?
Pretty well. So before we get to President Obama's budget, from what I understand, there was some shouting, some tempers going on in Congress this morning after a former IRS official pleaded the fifth on questions about the IRS targeting Tea Party groups. Fill us in on what happened.
Well, the deal was this is the official at the sort of center of this branch of the IRS that oversaw tax-exempt organizations. And as your listeners no doubt remember, the big scandal erupted last year when they admitted that they had delayed tax-exempt status for a bunch of political groups, most of which had Tea Party or something like it in their name. And a year ago, this woman, Lois Lerner, took the fifth and said she wasn't going to testify on Capitol Hill at a hearing because she might incriminate herself. The problem was she then answered a question, one question in that hearing, when they said, well, is this a real document? She said, that's my understanding of this real document, but I'm not testifying. The committee believes that when she answered that one question, she waived her rights to say that she wouldn't answer questions. So they called her back today and marched her through it again, and she answered it to every question. I will not answer questions. I will not answer questions. And the committee, basically the chairman, Daryl Issa, slams the gavel and says, okay, fine, we're not getting anywhere. We're going to close this hearing, and we're going to end the hearing, and we'll talk about contempt proceedings. Meanwhile, the Democrats said, hey, wait, we want to talk. But the chairman said, never mind, we're done here. And the Republicans all got up and started to leave the room. So the Democrats start chanting, shame, 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 mm-hmm. Let us talk. You know, this is political theater at its best. It was a circus. Ultimately, we learned absolutely nothing more about the Tea Party scandal than we knew yesterday, but it was fun to watch.
So Republicans are saying that to them, she waived her right to plead the fifth, even though she's pleading the fifth again. She's not answering questions. Is there a mechanism in place in Congress that can force her to testify?
Yeah, they could try to bring her up on charges of contempt of Congress, which, you know, that becomes actually a criminal proceeding at some point. It's hard to do. It would require, you know, the committee to vote on those charges and move from there. You know, what's interesting here is that the lawyer, after this hearing was over, her lawyer said, look, we were trying to negotiate a deal with the Republicans by which we would testify, but our sense was in the end it was simply a ploy to vilify us on television. And so I advised my client to instead repeat her Fifth Amendment rights. It's really interesting.
What kind of line is Lois Lerner walking right now as far as testifying goes?
Well, you know, it's a tough legal question, right? I mean, she's no longer in the government. She's a private citizen now. And she is saying that she puts herself in jeopardy. There are other investigations, including, I believe, FBI investigations of exactly what went on. Lois Lerner has also had threats against her, personal threats against her, once her name became public. You know, she's in a very tenuous position all around. And it does not necessarily do her any good, and certainly her lawyer would tell you this, doesn't do her any good to go sit in front of Congress and let them treat her like a piñata in front of the cameras.
Is the hope from the GOP that she will be forced to testify and that her words will somehow implicate the White House?
Probably. I mean, I don't mean to put intention in their minds. I think part of their intention is to keep this story alive. Clearly, Republicans believe that this was a White House orchestrated effort to punish the political opponents of the Obama administration. The White House and the Democrats would tell you that that is absurd. It was a bureaucratic bungling, of course, but not in any way motivated from the White House. I think to some degree, the Republicans are looking for testimony that would help make their case, but they're also, you know, an event like today was unnecessary. The only reason to really do it is to bring this story back up into the press.
So Republicans say that they're going to talk contempt charges. They adjourned, sounds like, and that's what they said they were going to be talking about. How soon could something like that happen?
I don't really know. And my suspicion is now we go back to, you know, remember this second appearance before the committee took almost a year to materialize. This could go on for a while. My suspicion is they'll have some more negotiations with the lawyer and see if they can work something out. Maybe they'll try to go for contempt proceedings sometime, you know, in a few months. I just don't know the timing of it.
Well, let's move on to President Obama's budget, which he sent yesterday. It's a $3.5 trillion plan. The New York Times called it a populist witch list. What are some of the major things that he's asking for?
Well, you know, he's asking for an expansion of the earned income tax credit for more lower income people to be able to take advantage of that. He's looking for a, you know, major investment in early childhood education and some workforce investment kind of things. He is, you know, looking to cap some corporate tax rates, or sorry, to expand close some corporate loopholes, tax loopholes. He at one point or another had talked about possibly changing the way Social Security cost of living adjustments are made in order to save a little money. That went out the window this year. But, you know, this is all a theoretical exercise. This is now a political document, not a budget document. I mean, it's not... No one expects this to be implemented. They've already got a budget agreement for this year and next year based on the deal that Congress struck earlier this year. So this is really just an opportunity for the president to say, this is my agenda, this is the Democratic agenda, this is what we believe in, never mind whether it actually ever gets implemented.
And apparently there was some pressure on him to submit a budget just like this, and from the looks of what he submitted, he's blowing past any conciliatory checkpoints, and it seems as though what he's asking for, and what he said he's asking for, is to signal a budget that favors upward mobility and the middle class. But could any of this actually get through Congress?
Well, you know, you can't necessarily blame him for blowing past any sense of sort of bipartisan cooperation, because there was really no format in which there was going to be a discussion anyway. There's no place to go to have that conversation. In fact, a couple of weeks ago, the White House said, look, we don't have a debate partner, a dance partner, I think they called it, on deficit issues. You know, we'd like to have a sort of a broader discussion about entitlements and sort of long-term spending and stuff, but we just don't. There's no way to get at it because the Republicans don't really want to talk about it. And frankly, at the moment, I don't think the Democrats do either. Everybody's happier just doing sort of posturing. So yeah, I mean, there actually are some things in here that they could agree on. I mean, I think they're, Dave Camp, the Ways and Means Committee chairman, today was talking about the tax plan that he likes, and some of that does actually match up with the president's lowering some of the top tax rates, maybe not so much, but cutting some of the corporate loopholes they could probably agree on. Even expanding the earned income tax credit they might be able to agree on. So, you know, there are bits and pieces of this that could be bipartisan, but there's just no format in which to have that discussion at this point.
So you call this a political document at this point, and I think the New York Times wrote that it could actually be, you know, a campaigning document. That's what it could be used for at this point. So what could its potential impact be?
Well, I mean, budgetarily, nothing. But in a campaign circumstance, you know, this is where Democrats get to go up and say, the Republicans want to shut down your government, want to give away tax breaks to the rich. Democrats want to do this stuff. Democrats want to, you know, expand government support for education. We want to expand tax credits for the poor. We want to crack down on corporations. So, you know, it's hard to know what the impact on that is because, you know, we don't know the outcome of these elections, but the impact, if nothing else, is this becomes our talking point. This becomes our agenda item.
And let's move on to one last thing before we let you go today. President Obama was blocked by the Senate earlier today when his nominee to head the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice was rejected by the Senate.
Yep.
And I wonder if you could talk us through what happened with that rejection.
Yeah, very interesting, in fact. The Democrats knew this was going to be a close vote on this guy whose name is Debo Degbola. They knew it was going to be a close vote because Degbola, no one doubts he's a very qualified civil rights lawyer. But a few years ago, he got involved in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, who mm-hmm. may be familiar to some of your listeners. Free Mumia movement has rattled among the left wing for 30 years. He is a black activist who was convicted of killing a police officer in Philadelphia in 1980-something, 81, I think. And he's been in jail, and he's on death row. And Adegbole was part of a team that convinced the courts to commute his sentence from death to life in prison. And law enforcement groups and a lot of Republicans are furious and have always been furious and believe that this is injustice for a police officer, basically. So they mounted a campaign against Adegbole, and they won. The Democrats knew it was going to be close. They had Joe Biden in the chair presiding over this vote to cast the tie-breaking vote if it got there. but they were still a vote short, and they couldn't even get to a tie. And so,
they must have known this was going to be an issue. They vet their candidates thoroughly. They just thought they had the numbers to push it through, it sounds like.
And I think people underestimated the backlash this would create, including among Democrats, and particularly Democrats from the Pennsylvania area. I mean, the two of the Democrats who were critical here were Casey, who's a Pennsylvania senator, and Coons, who's a Delaware senator who's right nearby. They had no choice because the movement around Philadelphia suburbs particularly is so strong.
All right, and we'll leave it there. Paul, thank you so much for joining us, as always.
My pleasure, Veronica. We'll talk to you again.
We've been talking to Paul Singer, politics and Congress editor at USA Today. He joins us every week at this time to share the ins and outs of the United States Congress.
The news. Well, not the news from NPR. Actually, a guide to making sense of our modern news landscape.
Ever since the inception of the 24-hour news cycle, criticizing it has been sometimes popular as consuming it. So do we really have enough news to fill 24 hours? And where did all the celebrity gossip come from and the demand for it? Do we need to know what celebrities are doing? Sometimes you might feel like you want to turn it off.
Author Alain de Botton says that news has become a new American pastime, and he's published a guide on how to approach it with a more critical eye. It's called The News, a User's Manual. He's also the author of best-selling nonfiction books about philosophy, love, and architecture, and he's the founder of the School of Life. Alain, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Well, at the outset, you write that the news has taken on a role that religion used to have. How authoritatively do people see the news?
Well, you know, think of even the name, The News. It sounds so authoritative. There's often booming voices, kind of sonorous music before the headlines come on. What the news never really tells you is that it's never, of course, the news. It's some news masquerading as the news. It's some news that some guys drinking styrofoam coffee, sitting around, try to fish out some stories to give their listeners a sense of what was going on out there. But it's very partial. And of course, I'm not the first person to say it, but the news regularly walks past some major issues of our day. It doesn't see them. And therefore, we have to take great care as consumers of the news to keep our wits about us, to be aware that the news is always going to have some blind spots, and that we need to put a limited amount of faith in the kind of things we're told. These are basic lessons. We're never taught them. You know, when you go to school, you get taught about literature and art and that kind of stuff. No one ever tells you really systematically how to deal with this thing called the news. And that's a very dangerous ignorance.
It's almost like trying to teach a fish about water. We're so immersed in the news, in our media, that it's hard to step aside from it, isn't it?
Yes, and of course, you know, let's remember that the dream of the news was tremendously ambitious. When news got going in Europe and then the United States in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, the promise was if you inform the citizenry, if you let people have information, then people will be able to make the right decisions, press their legislators to make the right decisions in government, and the world will flourish. That was the kind of dream of news. Well, things have happened a little bit differently to that nowadays. It's almost as though if you want to keep the population down, confused, supine, unable to change the status quo, you've got two options. The first option, very well practiced in North Korea, is to throttle the pipeline of news, to prevent people from getting any news. That way you can keep the population passive. But there's another kind of way of doing this. And this is cleverer, slyer, and arguably this is where we are in the United States now. You give people so much news, you flood them with news, that they can't work out what on earth's going on anymore. I mean, who of your listeners can remember what was on the news last week? No one can. It's a trial to remember what was on the news yesterday, because there's so much of it and there's confusion. So there's a real difference between what news could be and what it is. The promise of news is beautiful. It's information that can help us to flourish as individuals and as a nation. But the reality of news is compromised in 100 ways. And that's what my book's about. It's a look at what we as consumers need to know and how we can navigate the world of news more successfully.
Well, while we look at the news and we're awash in it, we're also skeptical of it, aren't we? I mean, when we see polls, the only thing that people like less than the media oftentimes is Congress. So why that disjuncture? We pay so much attention to the news, and yet we don't like our media.
Well, I think it's like a guilty feeling that we know that we trust the news so much, and then when somebody asks us, do you trust these guys? We go, oh, no, we don't like them. But look, by all accounts, people put immense faith in the news, and the news makes enormous claims. I mean, think of that famous strapline of the New York Times, all the news that's fit to print. There's never been a more arrogant, hubristic, asinine comment than that. All the news that's fit to print. Really? Are you sure? Have you checked it all out? In 2006, 10 blocks from the offices of the New York Times, there was one of the great financial scandals unfolding, and these guys failed to spot it. So they're telling us all the news that's fit to print, but they didn't capture it. So look, there constantly are blind spots in the news. But the news, we entrust it with an enormous power. You know, when we think of ourselves as Americans, we're living in America. What kind of a nation is America? Okay, most people don't have personal experience of America. They know their friends, their neighbors, their colleagues, their neighborhood, right? But this entity called the United States, that's something that the media has created for them. It's telling them how America is doing. Maybe the GDP is up or down. Maybe things seem to be going well or going badly. But these are messages that are emanating from the media. So the news does nothing less than to create our own nation in our imaginations.
Okay.
And that is a momentous power.
But there's a theoretically infinite number of things that I could throw just on a front page on any given day. There's got to be some kind of filter. It can't just map the entire reality. Is it possible to not have blind spots when you're trying to do that?
Right. Well, look, I think the first thing we have to watch out for is why on earth does the news keep reporting exactly the same news as all the other news outlets? And the reason is, well, you'll know if you've ever sat in a newsroom, you'll know exactly why. The people in the newsroom are all watching one another. They're not out there looking at the world. They're out there looking at the other media sources. So people at CNN will be watching what people at the BBC are doing, and people at the BBC are reading the New York Times, and people at the New York Times, listening to NPR, etc. It goes on and on. And, that is why there are these kind of mass delusions. But look, you're absolutely right. You're raising a really big question, which is, how on earth should a news outlet decide what is important? Now, my definition of news is that news is information that should help the individual and the nation to flourish. Now, news like that can help you to decide what pieces of information are useful or not. And a lot of what gets in the news, you almost feel like journalists haven't really thought about why it's there. They've just kind of served it up, and they just think it's important.
But it feels like news.
It feels like news. Absolutely. You've said it absolutely right. It feels like news, whereas actually, well, it's questionable that it really is doing anything for anyone. So there's an awful lot of, laziness, sloppy thinking going on. And it wouldn't matter if it wasn't such a powerful thing. You get traffic figures. I mean, here I am as a writer, right? A best-selling book might sell 100,000 copies, right? 200,000 copies. Things are going really well. That is a pathetic number compared to what a modest news website will get, which is, in the millions. And so that's telling us something about how powerful this engine is. It's right in the middle of our civilization, and it affects us more than we dare to imagine. It could do so much good, and yet, well, look, I've just been sitting in an airport watching CNN for an hour, and it's a confusing and dispiriting experience, and these guys are not even the worst. This stuff is trained to slightly drive us crazy and leave us very undernourished. What I'm constantly struck by is we know so much in theory. We know a little bit of so much, and yet we let so little of it have a proper impact on us. It would have astonished our great-grandparents who really did believe in the power of information to make a change. We lazily snack on these, bits of data that are not really doing anything for us.
One specific critique you have is that news, the consensual hallucination that makes up the news we have, focuses on bad things one way or another, a murder, a disaster, and not enough on stories of hope. Why is that an important change that you'd like to see?
Don't get me wrong. I'm nuanced on this point. I don't think the answer, I mean, there are people who go around saying, oh, there should be more cheerful news, right? I don't think it's necessarily the case that, you know, cheerful news is good, because there's lots of very annoying cheerful news, like, you know, grandmother celebrates, you know, her 99th birthday or something, you know, and you read that and, you know, it's as annoying as anything else. So that's not necessarily the answer. You know, cheerful news, you've got to be careful, really. My point is really that a news story can be, in a way, quite sad and still quite useful, quite interesting, quite helpful. And a news story can be quite good and also quite useful and quite interesting. So the point is more the utility. It's not good, bad. I don't want to divide up the cake, but on the axis of good and bad. And indeed, you know, many so-called bad stories have a very vital role to play. I've got a section in my book where I talk about disaster news, plane crashes, giant car crashes, sudden, you know, deaths at the hands of a tornado, etc., right? People love this sort of stuff. Now, why do they like this sort of stuff? Serious people tend to look down on this kind of news and go, well, you know, that's for stupid people who are not really, you know, focused on the big issues. I'm struck by the way that this kind of disaster news is really modern society's version of what in the Middle Ages was called a memento mori, a reminder of death, right? And in the Middle Ages, it was seen as absolutely normal that one of the pieces of interior decoration you might have on your desk was a skull. You would put a skull on your desk to remind you that at all times we're all quite close to death. And the point of this wasn't to depress you. It was to lead you to focus on the things that are really important, because the thought of death has a very vital role to play in kind of separating out the valuable and the non-valuable. And I think there's an echo of that when we are mesmerized by the story of, you know, a young mom who went out to buy a bag of chips and, you know, got mowed down suddenly by a crazy motorist or something. You know, as we're turning that story over in our mind, we're kind of trying to get in touch with some big ideas there. My problem with a lot of the news is that it's undigested. It doesn't offer closure or catharsis. It simply presents this kind of stuff to us. It doesn't tell us what we might do with it. And that's why it often leaves us with a kind of background of anxiety, undigested experience, going nowhere in particular. And that's my problem with it.
We're speaking with author Alain de Botton about how to make sense of today's news landscape. His new book is called The News, A User's Manual.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. Do you think that the news is a vacuous wasteland and it's hard to dig out those kernels of wisdom? And what do you think the news could be doing better to serve up meaning? We're back with author Alain de Botton talking about how to make sense of today's news landscape. His new book is called The News, A User's Manual.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you think the news has gotten out of hand? Do you have questions about how it works, or are you seeking advice on how to use it in your own life? You can join in at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. We'll get your calls in just a couple moments. But Alain, first, you're talking about how ultimately we get undigested bits of news here and there, but not really anything putting them all together. What would you like to see the news, the media, do differently to give us context, to tie those things together, make it relevant and useful to us?
Well, you know, we've just heard your latest bulletin, and your latest bulletin was nonsense because it was just a ragbag of sentences about a whole range of things. And I'm trying to imagine the person who really needed that bulletin in their life. It's like, okay, so President Obama has, you know, supporting the minimum wage, etc., and then on to another story, and on to another story, right? What is this for? Who at NPR made the decision that this was a good idea, right? That there's a kind of fundamental intellectual vacuum. People have not thought properly about how information can become effective in people's minds. And there's this idea that the new is always very important. It's the most important thing you could know. Of any area of human knowledge, the thing that happened in the last half hour is the most important. And that's why we need these constant updates. So the update is more important than any kind of steady state knowledge. Now, that is, of course, true at certain moments of national history, maybe in a war where there is, you know, very key bits of information coming through every 5 minutes. But most of the time, that's just not true. And what the constant update culture does is to break our concentration on the ongoing story. It's as if somebody was giving us a succession of novels, allowing us to read one sentence and then taking it away from us. We wouldn't be, ultimately what it does is it actually makes people bored because they can't grasp what the story is. You need a little bit of time. Now, I've spent some time in studios, and if you talk to, you know, harassed editors and you say to them after, you know, a long, hard day's work, you say to them, guys, why are you doing what you're doing? They will say, we are terrified that listeners are going to switch off. And so therefore, what we try and do is just bombard them with loads of stuff all the time so that we'll try and grab somebody. But that's like a very nervous, gabbling person who isn't able just to have the confidence to speak clearly for a while, maybe for 10 minutes, about something without being interrupted. But instead, there's this kind of congenital nervousness, and it reaches its pitch, of course, with 24-hour news, which changes about every 40 seconds. And most issues in life are not amenable to being treated in 40-second chunks. And so what you end up doing is both hooking the viewer, the audience, because it's very grabby to say, you know, not coming up now, we've got something exciting to tell you. So, you know, you stay and you listen, but you're not properly nourishing the person. And so it's a big problem.
But again, people in the media might say, this is what our viewers, our listeners, our readers want. They tell us they want the up-to-the-minute news. We are just providing the service that they're looking for and that keeps them tuning in.
Look, I mean, that's the McDonald's argument, and I have a lot of time for it. You know, the argument is don't blame us. We're merely frying up the burgers and making the fries. And, you know, if people are going to come through the doors and buy it, don't blame us. And I absolutely understand it. I suppose my view is, let's try and get a fast food restaurant that's a little bit better. Let's try and pull the customer base towards something a little bit more ambitious. You know, what's amazing is even though there's so many news outlets, they do tend to follow very, very much the same script. You know, news on the hour, call in, blah, blah, blah. You know, there's all sorts of things. And it's amazing how little diversity there actually is, even though there are so many platforms. Look, I think we're still at the dawn of the age of finding out how we can get the information we really need. I don't think as a society we are properly doing information gathering well. There's a lot of chatter, there's a lot of noise, there's a lot of static. Are we really getting to the stories that matter? Are we really getting them to the right people without driving them crazy? Are we placing the right levels of anxiety on people? Are people too anxious or not anxious enough, etc.? You know, I meet a lot of people who say things like, I've stopped listening to the news and my life's a lot better now. I don't think that's the answer, but I can sympathize with what might lead someone to that position.
I'm going to bring a caller in now. We've got Bill on the line in Greendale. Bill, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I think your guest is really spot on. I wonder what you think of Facebook. Now, here I'm on Facebook. I don't contribute. I don't post a lot, but my friends and family put on news that affects them. And then I might link on to it and find out more about it. And then I also wanted you to comment on The Daily Show and Colbert Report just to see what you think about those two shows.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Olin, social media is a way for us to help each other filter our news.
Well, look, I think there's something very interesting. There's news from outside. There's news that NPR might tell us. But there's also another kind of news, which is news from our own lives. Okay. Now, there's different ways of interpreting that. One way is to say that's news about like what my nephew's doing or when my cousin's birthday is. Okay, that's one kind of news. But there's another kind of news, which is literally news from within. What is my life? Where am I trying to get to? What are my ambitions? What are my regrets? Who am I? Right? Now, all of those questions get really squashed by Facebook and by the news and by everything else, by the chatter. It's very hard. It's increasingly hard nowadays to have a conversation with yourself, to get the news out of yourself, because there's this constant barrage of very prestigious distraction out there. And we have to take real care, because even though Facebook looks like, oh, that's about me and it's about personal thing, it's not really, really about you either. It belongs to that vast realm of constant and continual distraction. We need to take news Sabbaths. We need to step out and talk to ourselves. It sounds weird. It sounds mystical. It sounds like something Emerson or Thoreau would say. Good. That's precisely what I mean. It's the log cabin. It's the metaphorical log cabin. We need to go there and put the smartphone on the outside of the log cabin. As for Colbert, etc., these guys are doing great stuff, because they understand that in order to make news powerful, you have to work at it. You have to turn it into a joke or into art in some way. And too often news organizations think, we'll just put the important facts in front of people and then they'll respond. Well, no, you have to do something with it. You have to try and make those facts seem funny, deep, interesting, cogent, etc. So they belong, those humorists belong to people who are doing stuff with the raw material of the news. It doesn't have to be funny stuff always, though that's something that they've mastered, but it's just trying to digest this stuff a little more rather than just presenting it to the audience in a raw form.
All right, we'll take one more call from Marty in Milwaukee. Marty, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, great show. I'm sorry I caught it so late, but I guess I want to share with you Marty's law regarding news content. The law basically is very simple. The likelihood of a story to get to the air, and I'm speaking primarily of commercial broadcasters, is in inverse proportion to the cost of providing that story. In other words, when you have a snowstorm and you can show somebody shoveling the snow in front of their house, it's anticipated, it's predicted, but you'll see it every single time because it's cheap to cover. If you're talking about an investigative report that's going to require time and you don't even know where it's going to lead, you're not going to even see the story. I think it lowers everyone's expectations.
Thanks for the call, Marty. Alan, that's in part related to the laziness you talked about earlier.
Yeah, I mean, look, I sympathize with newsrooms that have got small budgets, and I don't necessarily think the answer is to send everybody out to Africa or far-flung places. You know, what I really think people need to do is think. And thinking is cheap in terms of, pure dollar terms. What you need is a, empty room and a clear head, and you need to think, okay, what are we trying to do with this storm story? What are we trying to do with this budget or Congress story, etc.? And I just think because of the 24-hour news cycle, journalists, and I say poor journalists because they are under immense pressure, they are running like, hamsters in a proverbial cage, and they do not have time to make sense of the information, and therefore they are confusing the entire nation. And it leads to the situation we have now, which is a very well-informed citizenry that knows nothing.
We'll leave it there. Alan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with author Alain de Botton about how to make sense of today's news landscape. His new book is The News, A User's Manual.